time being 8:15, the House Human Service Finance and Policy Committee will come to order. Representative, and we do have a quorum. Representative Vernick moves the minutes for adoption for March 25th, 2026. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to be made to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the minutes for March 25th, 2026, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes are approved from March 25th, 2026. First on the agenda today is an update from the Department of Human Services on their CMS and revalidation update with Director Grom. And just a note, ahead of time, we didn't ask Director Grom to be prepared for questions today. We submitted a few ahead of time just to kind of get an angle, but we expect that throughout the rest of the committee time, we'll be getting more updates like this. And so if there are specific questions, to just send those by email to get that updated, and then we can continue those in the updates as we move forward. So when you are ready, Director Grom, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Christy Grom with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. I'm happy to be here and provide a quick update before the business that the committee is going to take up today. So I was asked to come and give an update on our Minnesota Revalidate 2026 process. Many members know that Medicaid revalidation is something that we do on a regular basis at the department, but we are currently under what we call an off-cycle revalidation. So I'll just walk through a little bit of the background and where we're at with that process right now. So revalidation is a mandatory activity that state Medicaid agencies have to do as required by federal law. So CMS and the federal code outline some of the specifics on what's required, but effectively this is a process, to verify that when people are enrolling, when providers are enrolling or revalidating their enrollment, that they're submitting updated credentials, all of their practice details and compliance information to make sure that they're in alignment with federal and state law. So moderate and limited risk providers do this process typically every 5 years, whereas high risk providers or service types do this process every 3 years. Recently, as I mentioned at the outset here, CMS asked DHS to revalidate all of our providers that are delivering high risk services by the end of this May. So that is a very tremendous effort that the agency is currently under. It's, as I mentioned, we consider it an off-cycle revalidation. Normally, we revalidate providers, a handful of them every year, and then we can make sure that they're revalidated every 3 years, but this is squeezing all of what's usually years worth of work into just a couple of months here. So we officially launched this process in January, the end of January. We've got about 5,500 provider sites that we will be revalidating between January and the end of May. Initially, and I think on this slide I note 5,800, sorry, that number is a little bit outdated. When we started doing this work, we were looking at the data to really understand the precise number as we're timing out the various benchmarks we need to hit to accomplish the goal. And what we found is that some of the providers actually are on the same service type or on the same provider record, and so that counts as one validation. So we're actually looking at about 5,500 sites that we'll be validating. And again, as I mentioned, this is just a really rigorous process that we don't normally do in just a couple of months. It spans over a few years. So we formally started this off-cycle revalidation by sending a letter. So all of the high-risk provider types received a letter at the end of January. As of earlier this week, there's about 4,962 providers left to fully revalidate in this process. So that's a significant amount. And that number includes what's required in terms of updating the provider file, the paperwork, the background study, as well as the site visit. So we've got about 550 that are completely done, but I just want to highlight that there are more that are partway through the process and nearing completion, but that is the number that I wanted to share with the committee this morning. So again, this is a huge effort. We've got staff from across the enterprise helping with this. And lastly, before I head to the next slide, I would just say that we are using this challenge to look at our current process of revalidation and figure out how we can do better. So right now we have a pretty manual process, and we are, as a part of this effort, because we have to do so much in a short amount of time, modernizing how we do all of our revalidations. So we'll be learning lessons going forward for provider revalidation. So this slide is a snapshot of when I say we're validating or we're modernizing our revalidation. This is a snapshot of what we're moving towards. So over the course of 2 months, we've moved from what was a very manual, I would say people have described it to me as clunky, paper or SharePoint-based revalidation to this automated checklist tool where we've got the data visualization dashboard that you see in front of you. This dashboard is always changing, so I really am not showing it, and it's hard to read. I'm not showing it for you to see the precise data, but I want you to get a sense of the way that we're approaching this project. It is pretty sophisticated, and we've outlined some benchmarks, but basically we're streamlining the work by dividing this provider universe across the state into 7 regions based on provider density. So we've got Anoka-Ramsey is one region, Carver, Dakota, Scott, Washington another, Hennepin County is its own region, and then we've got the Northeast, Northwest, Southeast, and Southwest regions of the state. So we've got them bucketed out into 7 regions. And then from there, the regions are divided into smaller grids. So you can't see it on this snapshot, but we can take a closer look, we can hone in, and create smaller grids. So it's sort of like when you're canvassing a neighborhood, members might be familiar with that, you cut turf, you figure out where are all the places I need to hit to talk with people, and that's what we're doing, something similar here to identify where is the density and how can we be efficient with our site visits and making sure that we get to those providers as quickly as possible without having to send people driving across the state or across regions, which can be quite large. So the dashboard you can see shows updates in terms of providers that aren't ready for a visit, so they haven't completed their paperwork, they haven't responded, they're ready for a visit and the visit's complete. And then there's revalidation outcomes listed, so pending, approved, and we're tracking all of this by region. So just wanted to give you all a snapshot of the way we're approaching this work. So this is such an enormous effort. We are trying our best to over-communicate, and we're really working to find new ways to connect with providers. As I mentioned, impacted providers got the initial letter in January. They got a reminder at the end of February. We are now approaching when they had 60 days to respond. So there is a bucket of providers, about 1,395 was the last number that I received, that have not yet responded. So we are doing our best. We are making phone calls to all of these providers. I think we've made, since the beginning of this month, about 3,300 individual phone calls to providers. We've got an advisory group that the commissioner, myself, Deputy Commissioner Conley meet with on a biweekly basis to get feedback from provider associations and figure out what do we need to do, who are we missing. We're looking at the provider types that haven't responded and trying to understand, are they specific provider types? We've stratified the data by region. So we are really, we've got all hands on deck. This is a collaborative effort with providers to be able to get this done. In addition to all of the letters and the phone calls that we've been doing, we've got the weekly roundtables that we do. I believe we have daily technical assistance for providers that they can log on and get daily technical assistance if they're having trouble with the process. We've got on-demand instructional videos. Those are all on our website that we've got, and so if members are ever curious, you can take a look at them. Probably not as sophisticated as we would like, but again, this is a requirement that CMS is asking us to do, and we are setting out to complete it in the best way that we know how. So the steps, the specific steps are, there's 5 listed on the screen here, but it's really 3 parts. So providers need to update their provider record that's on file with us. There's all kinds of documents that they have to submit and update as a part of that. They have to make sure that they get their enhanced background study if they haven't already, or make sure that those are all current. There's a fee that goes along with that, which is... we can talk about, and then there's also a fee related to updating the revalidation, which is required by CMS. And then lastly, they get the site visit, and hopefully, if all goes well, we complete that site visit and approve their revalidation. So just to talk a little bit more about each of these steps. So updating the provider enrollment record is really, typically the provider goes online, They've got their enrollment record, and they're updating their phone number, their electronic fund transfer, their remittance settings, their addresses, their physical address, all of their various demographic information that we need to be able to track them and understand where they're at, where they're doing business. They have to submit credentials, so licenses that individual providers might hold, assurance statements or proof of insurance. We do verify all of the credentials that are submitted, either through our public-facing databases, or we will reach out to the licensing boards directly. And then there's a whole host of agreements and addendums that providers need to update and sign as a part of that, making sure that they're saying, you know, we understand if we do something wrong, we're subject to monetary recovery, that kind of thing. With that provider enrollment is making sure that they've got their fingerprint-based criminal background studies done. So background studies are required for all direct and indirect owners that have interest of 5% or more of the organization. And these studies have to be complete before moving on to the next step in revalidation. There is a fee, I think it's $44 right now, to complete those background studies. I know we get a lot of questions and complaints about background studies, and I do just want to say for the record, I think about 80% of our background studies are complete within 2 days. Of course, there are unique situations with every provider type, but happy to talk more with members about that. All right, and then moving to the unannounced site visit. So this is a federally required item that's part of revalidation. To support the program integrity and making sure that, you know, we've got everything in place. We're taking a look at the physical space ourselves and looking at the records that we need to confirm that they are, that providers are meeting the requirements of both state and federal law. So we've been meeting a lot with providers talking about what to expect during site visits. We need to make sure that providers allow reasonable access to the business location. They have to make sure that authorized individuals are available to meet with the screener. These happen during the listed business hours of the provider. They typically take less than an hour. We've heard some providers saying they're taking longer, but that is generally about an hour is what we're finding. And we're basically going in and verifying their enrollment information that they've submitted online and making sure that everything looks right. If providers, there's been questions around what if I'm not there, there are opportunities because these are unannounced site visits for providers to get a visit if they aren't there. We communicate with them about why they weren't there, and then we will just reschedule another unannounced visit. And then hopefully if all goes smoothly, the provider passes the screening and unannounced visit and we complete the revalidation and send them a letter noting that. Mr. Chair, that's what I had. Were there any questions that you or members had that I didn't answer in the course of this presentation?
Thank you, Director Graham. I think that covered what we were looking for initially with this. And again, members, if you have questions about this particular report, you can take those offline with Director Graham. We expect to have the director back with more updates in further committee appearances. And we also want to get through our next bill today and not come back tomorrow. So with that.
Mr. Chair, did you want an update on the corrective action plan to your boss to your right? For that, or I can wait.
Director Graham, yes, if you have something prepared briefly, please.
Sure. I will just mention to the committee that last week we received a letter from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, indicating that they approved Minnesota's corrective action plan. So that was after about 7 weeks of waiting to hear from them. We did hear back. They didn't have any revisions. We were surprised because it had been quite some time before we'd heard from them. But basically, this is good news for the state. We are really pleased. The letter indicated that with ongoing compliance of the corrective action plan, that they were requesting to stay the withholding, which is there is currently an administrative action underway to address the proposed withholding that CMS issued earlier this year. That was about a $2 billion withholding. So we are in conversation with CMS. We will be responding this week. They've asked for a few items, in particular an update on revalidation, which I just described. As you can see, we have a long way to go, but we're hoping to show them good progress. They've also adjusted our timeline during which we have to meet with them. So it used to be weekly meetings. They proposed a different cadence of meetings, just meeting with them when we meet our various milestones of the corrective action plan. So all in all, this is good news. There is some confusion because we've heard conflation between the deferral, the $250 million or so per quarter deferral with the $2 billion withholding. And so we've heard from Dr. Oz and others at CMS that if the corrective action plan was approved by CMS, that they would end the proposed deferral. And we are reaching out to them to ask them if that is going to indeed be the case. Again, it's confusing because the corrective action plan was associated with the withholding, not the deferral, but we hope to show the federal government that we are in good faith meeting the requirements, and in fact, the things that we proposed in the corrective action plan were items that the agency was already doing prior to involvement with CMS. So we're pleased with that outcome and happy to provide more updates, Mr. Chair, as we move forward.
Director Graham, thank you for that update as well, and we look forward to further updates at future hearings. Next on the agenda, finally on the agenda for today, House File 729, Representative Knorr. And as Chair Knorr makes his way to the testifying table, he moves that House File 729 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. And as he continues to get prepared, just a kind of a walkthrough, members and the public, of how we plan to go through the amendment process here. We're going to start with the A2 amendment for adult maltreatment, then the A3 amendment for senior nutrition, and I'll go over this again as we continue through. A2, A3, then the A5 amendment for MA provider enrollment requirements, the A7 amendment from direct care and treatment, the A6-1 amendment for EIDBI, the A8 amendment, which is technical assistance, the A10 amendment, the A9 amendment for behavioral health, and the A11 amendment for the MDH policy. So, Mr. Chair, whenever you are ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the roadmap. Just wanted to start with by moving the DE, Mr. Chair.
All right. And Chair Knorr moves the DE2 amendment. Mr. Chair, to your amendment.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. This is the overall bill for the policy that we have, but I just wanted to note that we have walked through the DE2, and to that I have an A2 amendment to DE2.
All right. Chair Knorr moves the A2 amendment. Chair Knorr, to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A2 amendment is updating the vulnerable adult system to make sure that we have some accountability in the systems, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on the A2 amendment? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Are there questions to the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Next, we will go to the A3 amendment. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. I'd like to move the A3 amendment. This is the senior nutrition policy recommendations that modifies the language for senior citizens to older adults and also allows more flexibility in the way the funds are used. I'd ask for your support.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Fisher. Is there anyone in the public who wishes to testify on the A3 amendment? Seeing none, member discussion. The A3 amendment. Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A3 amendment is adopted. Next, we have the A5 amendment. Representative Hicks moves the A5 amendment. Representative Hicks.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I move the A5 amendment. This is the pre-enrollment information strengthening enrollment on the front end to try to prevent fraud on the back end. It also does the same thing as Representative Franson's bill from the other day, requiring the department to clarify the correct federal statute. I just appreciate your support.
Is there anyone in the public who wishes to testify on the A5 amendment? Seeing none, any member discussion on the A5 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A5 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A5 amendment is adopted. Next, Representative Frederick moves the A7 amendment. Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when we heard the drug care and treatment bill, I had an amendment on there talking about data provisions and how clients in the sex offender program were using data requests to get information on the staff. The department flagged for me that while that amendment covered the majority of the program sites, it was not all-inclusive. And so this amendment just expands it to make sure that we were covering all staff in that program.
Thank you, Representative Frederick. We have Marshall Smith, who was looking to testify on the A7 amendment. You can please make your way forward. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Yeah, good morning, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Marshall Smith, and I'm the health system CEO for Direct Care and Treatment, the state-operated behavioral health care system. I'll be brief. I'm here today to thank the committee, including DCT's policy revisions in the DE amendment for the policy omnibus bill. These measures are essential to DCT's operations. They will allow us to share important information with regulators and accrediting bodies, law enforcement, and courts when necessary. It will help us manage certain sex offender program data, update statutes to accurately reflect DCT's governance, and help us to retain clinical and professional staff. Most importantly, the changes will have a tremendous positive impact on patient care. They clear away obstacles that impede our ability to provide care to patients with urgent treatment needs who are unable to make medical decisions for themselves. They allow longer return stays for certain patients who need to come back to our facilities for follow-up care. On behalf of our patients, clients, and staff, thank you for recognizing the importance of including these provisions in the policy bill. We're grateful for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on the A7 amendment? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Member discussion? Seeing none, any final words, Representative Frederick? I'm having a senior moment here. Just a second. All those in favor of adoption of the A7 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A7 amendment is adopted. Next, we have the A6-1 amendment. Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the Disability and Aging Article. Policy changes to that section.
Is there anyone in the public who wishes to testify on the A6-1 amendment? Seeing none, member discussion on the A6-1 amendment. Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A6-1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Next, the A8 amendment. Representative Gilman.
Thank you so much. This amendment is a technical support from DHS to fix things up. So, again, technical assistance was given. We appreciate that. As a reminder, House File 3520 was adopted in, when was it, March 4th. And again, policy changes, clarifications aimed at addressing some of the specific issues that are creating barriers in access to mental health services. So again, we're very grateful for this inclusion in the omnibus policy bill.
Thank you, Representative Gilman. And to be official, Representative Gilman moves the A8 amendment. Is there any discussion, public testimony from the A8 amendment? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Discussion to the A8 amendment. Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A8 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A8 amendment is adopted. Next, Representative Frederick moves the A10 amendment. Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also want to thank Representative Gilman for the the help in this amendment in what's being included or not included. So say it's kind of a team effort. So the amendment talks about services start discharge summary and that it's still due within 5 days, but we are not going to be counting weekends or holidays. It talks about withdrawal management services and updates to the claims adjustment process. And there are testifiers here that can talk about that briefly as well.
Thank you, Representative Frederick. First on the list for testifiers, we have Tammy Roth. Via Zoom. Okay, while we're waiting for Tammy to get ready, we'll come back to her. Lance Egley. Also online.
I'm going to testify on the clawback part, so I see Sammy is on. Perhaps we'd let her go ahead.
We have you up. I'll take my chances with you, Lance.
Okay. Thank you, Honorable Co-Chair Schumacher and Mara, and members of the House Human Services Finance Committee. My name is Lance Egley. I have over 30 years' experience in substance use disorder, providing treatment and training for staff. Worked with the, for 4 years, leading the paperwork reduction and systems improvement effort, which included looking at billing. And one of the barriers we found was clawbacks that happened way past the time when the payment was made originally. I'm here testifying on behalf of MARCH and the paperwork simplification to support modifying Minnesota Statute 62Q.72 Subdivision 4 to limit the over 1 year exemptions to only the purposes of fraud or abuse. Providers really can't imagine why a payer would need more than a year to recognize a clawback. The Minnesota Council of Healthcare Plans was asked about that, and they did not provide an answer. For budgeting purposes, providers need to know their income is secure and theirs to spend. 16 other states have a 1 year or shorter limit on the amount of time you can have for a clawback. Some clawbacks are so far from the original payment date that even the payer no longer has records to explain what the original thinking was in paying the payment. This creates a deeply unbalanced system. Billing rules change frequently, at least annually, and the clawbacks are often based on new rules that didn't apply at the time that the billing was submitted and paid. A 1 year limit reduces confusion about whether billing rules apply. It allows providers to reasonably plan their annual budget. Unpredicted clawbacks for payments over 1 year undermine budget planning. You may hear from when Lionel testifies some examples of cases where rules were applied differently. I have 10 cases in my written testimony that describe in detail. March also provided a survey about the scope of clawbacks. There were 30 distinct organizations responding. More than two-thirds of them had clawbacks older than a year. Some were clawbacks from payments back as far as 2021. They were distributed of all the categories that we asked to remove from the one-year exemptions, the time limit, and they cost an average of $29,207. Two of them were over $100,000. Collectively, $453,800. That was just the last clawback. There were 220 additional previous clawbacks identified. So when payers long delay clawbacks, providers can't rely on past earnings Some sawbacks have been big enough to bankrupt the small provider. It is the main reason the law should change. Change will also reduce the opportunity for claims based on the wrong rules for the time that the payment was just paid, or somehow not in good faith for justice. Providers carry a disproportionate share of financial risk. This bill is about creating fair, predictable, and balanced practices. I urge you to support this change to protect health care providers who serve our community every day. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Eagley. Next, we'll try Tammy Roth again.
Hi.
Hi, Tammy. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
My name is Tammy Roth. I've worked in the addiction field for almost 14 years. I've been a licensed alcohol and drug counselor for the last 5.5. I'm here to speak on statute 245G.06, subdivision 4A, to make changes to the discharge summary. Addiction counseling staff are frequently stretched thin due to workforce shortages, excessive documentation requirements, and a desire to provide high-quality client care. When a program determines that a client is eligible for discharge, the primary counselor currently has 5 calendar days to complete a summary of termination of services, also known as a discharge summary. If their schedule for the week is full between group and individual sessions, care coordination with others involved in the client's treatment, and paperwork and billing timelines, it can be difficult to add this task. As a result, counselors often work beyond their scheduled hours or outside of facility operating hours to maintain agency compliance. This proposal is simple: to change the timeline in statute 245G.06 subdivision 4A from 5 days to 5 business days so that weekends and holidays can be excluded from the time requirements for completing discharge summaries. I respectfully request your support in these changes to ease pressure on addiction counseling staff. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Roth, for your testimony. Next, we have Brian Zervies. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Brian Zervis. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Resources for Recovery and Chemical Health, otherwise known as MARCH. I'm going to be speaking on the withdrawal management section of the A10 amendment. Withdrawal management is a medical form of detox licensed in Minnesota. It's important to note that in the end of 2025, 2 programs have closed. The language in the amendment would exempt authorizations until 5 days after service initiation starts. Withdrawal management programs oftentimes operate as an emergency service. This amendment will help enhance a program's ability to get paid for the services rendered. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zervis. Next, we have Lena Roth. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Lena Roth. I have worked in healthcare revenue cycle management for over 20 years. My work has focused on insurance claims, reimbursement, and ensuring providers are paid accurately for the care they deliver to patients across Minnesota. I'm here today to support A10 amendment in reference of claim adjustment timeline in limiting insurance recoupments beyond 12 months to cases involving fraud or abuse. This proposal does not prevent payers from recouping funds in the situations already outlined in the statute. It simply establishes reasonable time limits for doing so. It ensures that recoupments happen when records are available, facts are verifiable, and providers have a fair chance to respond. The current statute is not functioning as it is intended. While it outlines the specific types of claims where recoupments may occur, insurance companies continue to recoup payments sometimes as much as 4 to 7 years later after claims have been processed and paid, often without sufficient justification and without giving providers meaningful opportunity to respond. At least 16 states have already addressed this issue by limiting recruitments beyond 12 months to cases of fraud or abuse. Health plans continue to operate in those states successfully, which demonstrates that timely review and responsible oversight are entirely achievable. Minnesota is known for having one of the strongest healthcare systems in the country, but that system is built on providers who are increasingly being asked to absorb unpredictable financial risk. This bill does not remove accountability, it reinforces it by requiring that accountability happens within reasonable and responsible timeframes. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Roth, for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on the A-10 amendment? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Member discussion on the A-10 amendment? Any final word, Representative Frederick?
I just want to thank the committee for hearing the bill, or for the amendment. With the shortened time frame, we weren't able to get it drafted as a full bill ahead of time for the committee to hear, so it's drafted this way, and I appreciate Representative Gilman's teamwork in this effort.
Thank you. With that, Representative Frederick renews his motion to adopt the A-10 amendment. All those in favor of the A-10 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A-10 amendment is adopted. Next, Representative Fisher moves the A-9 amendment. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. I move the A-9. This is the behavioral health section that we heard the other day. Would like to get it added into the bill today. Thank you.
Is there anyone who wishes to testify on the A-9 amendment? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Member discussion on the A-9 amendment. Seeing none, Representative Fisher renews his motion of adoption of the A-9 amendment. All those in favor of adoption signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The A-9 amendment is adopted. Next, we have Representative Vernig moving the A-11 amendment. Representative Vernig.
Yes, thank you. This is the MDH policy bill. It clarifies survey compliance. Chapter 144D cleanup establishes standards around the use of restraints, clarifies responsibility when facilities change ownership. We heard it earlier this week. After the bill was heard, the long-term care imperative and MDH came to agreement on the provisions related to the use of restraints.
That's great. Is there anyone who wishes to testify on the A-11 amendment? Seeing none, member discussion to the A-11 amendment. Seeing none, Representative Vernig renews her motion that the A-11 amendment be adopted. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A-11 amendment is adopted. That is all I have for amendments here. Before we go to adoption of the DE-2 as amended, we'll take public testimony on the DE-2 as a whole. I have Nate Olson. If you could make your way forward. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. I'm Nathaniel M. Olson. Again, we did not get this bill passed yesterday. I'm the disability advocate for the state of Minnesota. So I believe that this bill needs to get passed as soon as possible. We do need help for people with disabilities in the state of Minnesota. And what I saw yesterday, I was heartbroken what I saw. And I can do all that I can to testify for these people. But oh man, it's not supposed to cry today. It's getting quite worrisome here right now. Everything that's going on. I need you guys to vote yes on this bill because this bill needs to get passed. Because if we do not get this bill passed, a lot of disability people are just not going to have services. So I'm just begging you, please get this bill passed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on the DE-2 amendment as amended? Seeing none, public discussion is closed. Member discussion to the DE-2 as amended. Representative Hicks.
I would just like to say, are we going to be the first committee to get a package of bills out Are we going to win? Are we winning? Sorry.
We're visiting.
Final word on the DE2 amendment, Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a comprehensive bill that strengthens programs and systems so they work better for the people who depend on them every day. It raises the standards for accountability, improves coordination across systems, and reinforces protection for Minnesotans who are too often at risk of being overlooked or harmed. Mr. Chair, member, this bill updates provider oversight and public programs, strengthens safeguards around public funds, and makes it clear that quality care, transparency, accountability, responsibility must go hand in hand. Members, this bill strengthens provider oversight by clearly defining responsibility for compliance, establishes a stronger risk-based framework. These changes help ensure that those entrusted with public resources meet the highest standard of integrity and quality. Members, this bill also takes important steps to protect vulnerable adults by improving how reports of abuse, neglect, and financial exploitations are handled. It strengthens coordination across agencies, clarifies responsibilities, and helps ensure that responses are timely, consistent, and effective, while preserving strong data privacy protections. It also helps ensure the people facing mental health and substance use disorder who are faced with challenges can get the care and support they need when they need it most. This bill promotes informed choice, supports community-based living, and advances person-centered policies that respect dignity, independence, and stability. It also strengthens patient protection, clarifies medical consent procedures, and safeguards sensitive data while improving overall accountability and system performance. Members, this bill builds a more responsive, transparent, and person-centered system. It protects public resources, supports providers who are doing the right thing, and helps ensure Minnesotans receive the care, safety, dignity that they deserve. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I ask for your support.
With that, Chair Knorr renews his motion that the DE2 amendment as amended be adopted to the House File 729. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The DE2 amendment as amended is adopted. And then Chair Knorr renews his motion that House File 729 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion passes, and House File 729, as amended, is re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Well, we got an hour. I apologize for not taking the full committee
Chair,
time.
Mr. Chair, we forgot to sing for you yesterday when you...
No, you didn't. You absolutely did not, Mr. Chair.
Happy belated birthday, so maybe members can join me in wishing Chair Schumacher a happy birthday.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Joe. Happy birthday to you.
We made it.
All right, we're adjourned.